Welcome to the ABCA's podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Brownlee. New podcast sponsor is Aware Sports. Are you looking to improve your use of video for player development, live streaming, instant replay, or opponent scouting? Most coaches answer yes. That's how Aware Sports began, to solve the video challenges in baseball and softball. Whether using their multi-angle fixed camera system or their mobile software, Aware empowers coaches to maximize every aspect of video all in one comprehensive solution. Their users range from MLB teams and reigning collegiate national champions to strong high school programs and literally everything in between. So the real question becomes, will you turn video into a powerful tool to elevate your program or stick with the status quo? You can find out more information at awaresports.com. That's awresports.com. Thanks for listening. This episode is sponsored by Netting Pros. Netting professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Netting Professionals specializes in the design, fabrication, and installation of custom netting for backstops, batting cages, dugouts, BP screens, and ball carts. They also design and install digital graphic wall padding, windscreen, turf, turf protectors, dugout benches, dugout cubbies, and more. Netting Professionals is an official partner of the ABCA and continues to provide quality products and services to many high school, college, and professional fields, facilities, and stadiums throughout the country. Netting Professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Contact them today at 844-620-2707 or info@nettingpros.com. Visit them online at www.nettingpros.com or check out Netting Pros on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn for all their latest products and projects. Make sure to let CEO Will Miner know that the ABCA sent you. Now on to the podcast. Back again on the ABCA podcast is PSP3 owner and director of sports performance, Nathan Hempel. Hempel is no stranger to the ABCA, having been a guest on the podcast in 2022, spoke at a Royals Barnstormers in 2021, and was on the main stage this year at the convention. All of those are great resources to dive into. This episode is all about some of the new assessments that PSP3 is using with their athletes. Hempel's been training baseball players for almost 20 years and has developed a great track record for keeping players healthy and thriving on the field. PSP3 now has 4 facilities in the Kansas City area. Let's welcome Nathan Hempel to the podcast.
Yeah, somebody convinced me to get a monitor from the laptop for doing like programming and things like that. Yeah. So need that kind of stuff. And then like I got one. I'm like, this is amazing. Why have I ever not done it?
You don't know what you don't know.
That's true. That's true. That's correct. So how's Knoxville? Were you there for the series or what?
Yeah, I just went for the Super because I played and coached at Evansville. And okay. My dad was going to be there. I saw a bunch of guys that I had not seen since I was done playing with. So it was really cool to reconnect. Sure. And Wes, their head coach, actually coached for 2 years at Evansville before I left to go to James Madison. And then his brother and I played 3 years. His brother was an 11-year big leaguer who helps Wes out sparingly, but he was there. He was there through the conference tournament and regionals and supers. My dad actually kind of just traveled with them through the conference tournament, the regionals, and the supers. So it was great. They played well. I mean, look at what happened in the World Series. I think if Evansville hadn't have gotten matched up with Tennessee, they may have had a chance to get to Omaha because their team was so good. It's just,
yeah,
Tennessee's really good, really good.
They are, and they keep throwing. You know, it's with those smaller teams, you run out of a guy,
yes,
or you waste a guy in the first game. It's like hopefully we can get to the third one because it's just crazy. The depth that they have, and then of course like. It's amazing the shuffling that happens so fast these days in college sports. It's like A&M's done. All of a sudden, here they're doing now. You know, he's going to Texas, and then also
like half their teams in the portal now. Like, how many of those guys will end up there? Will they end up somewhere else? Will they end up back at A&M? I feel for the college guys because they're dealing with a lot of stuff that I never had to deal with. So you feel for those guys because there's always that trickle down effect. It's like. know, in our area, we've got schools that just head coaches left, so their whole team's in the portal. And it's like, what are we just not going to field a team? So, you know, that's
right.
But they're playing the cards they're dealt. You know, that's the thing for the college guys is this is what they were dealt, so they've got to deal with it the best that they can. Like, and until we put guardrails, and I recorded on this 3 years ago and said that this is what it was going to look like if we didn't put any guardrails on it, and it's exactly what I thought it was going to look like when you don't put any guardrails on it.
Yeah, we have a kid.
I don't think athletes want it either. I'm working youth camp this week with college kids. And I don't think they want it this way either. Just talking to them, I think they would like to see some guardrails put up too.
Help protect them. Yeah, I think that part of the thing that the kids thought was great in the beginning because they can make some money. Now they're realizing they need to be protected because they're not. Like, we've got a guy who just transferred pitcher. He was a mid weekend starter to start, ended up being like a midweek starter, but he was like, they're not really progressing me as well as, like, you know, the money these kids are, other guys are coming in getting is more than me. Like, I'm already lost. And it was like, who's at fault? It's probably a little bit of both.
Yeah.
It's an unfortunate circumstance where we are now. And some of these schools, which will be intriguing, I think, to see, is some of these schools that are like, no, we're not doing NLI at all. We refuse to do it. If their talent starts to dip, because it's sad.
I think what is eventually going to happen, is it will go into a collective bargaining thing where NIL is going to go away, where each school will have a set amount of money, the same amount of money. Everybody will have the same amount of money to divvy out among the athletes. I still think you should have to spend a year in residency before you qualify for any NIL money. I think that there needs to be guardrails that if you have played and were on scholarship or getting NIL money, you can't transfer. Unless your coach leaves, which is that's always been free transfer. If a coach leaves, is
right.
It's always been that way.
Right. Yeah. Not if you're unhappy with how things are going or whatnot.
Because we talk about that with 18 to 23 year olds. They're very rarely going to be happy about everything.
Anything. Yeah. Well, and we talked about it years ago. And it was like, what if we made a rule where you had to graduate college to get your money? So like you use this pool and there's going to be some guys that don't ever graduate college. And maybe there's a stipulation where if you are playing a professional sport for X amount of years, then you get the money too. Or, hey, congratulations, you're playing pro sports, you don't need the money or something of that nature.
You hit a lifetime amount of money, right. You don't need the money. So there's a lot of different directions you can go with that. But the way it is now, it's not fair to anybody.
No. And it's unfortunate too, because like you said, with 18 to 19 year old kids, like, they have no clue. They used to chase the logo and the cool gear and all that. Now they're chasing which donors can give you the most money to go to the school. And we all know a lot of these kids don't go anywhere outside of 200, 300 mile radius of their own home because it's just a new thing for them anyway.
Yep.
So,
and social media has exacerbated all of it because, you know, not to this extent, but kids were transferring in the past, but now it's just like, it's in your face. So you're paying attention to it more. So now I'm sure every kid that's in college is like, well, everybody else is doing, and you look at the numbers, it seems like everybody else is doing it. So I'm going to try it too, but
sure.
That's where it's still an individual basis thing. And you have to do what's best for you. And Evansville is a great example of that. They had guys that had been there for 4, 5, and 6 years. And it just shows that if you can keep your guys around, even at a mid-major like that, you can do something historical. And that's where, as a coach, you need to try to hold on to your guys if you can, to just show that, hey, there's an example out there that if everybody stays together here, you can do some damage, some big ways.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And those great teams that are a bunch of really good players thrown together by an jumble don't do so well because there's no cohesive unit. They're not together. They're all kind of on their own island. As well as, like, you know, when playoff time comes, like, experience trumps almost anything because it's just a different realm. Especially, I remember when I was in the college setting, like, it was probably early May, mid-May, half of our freshmen just died because they were not used to the volume of what we were doing with them in terms of games and whatnot. And it goes a long way, especially because the season, you know, a lot of people don't understand, like, you don't just play like a bowl game in baseball and you're done. Like, you're playing a mini bowl, like a three-series bowl game. Another three-series bowl game, and then you play another three-series bowl game to get to where you need to be, and it's a lot. It really is. So,
Here with Nathan Hempel again, owner of PSP3 in Kansas City, but has multiple facilities now, but spoke at the ABCA convention this year, and so thank you for that. But another, had a great Barnstormers video too, a long time ago, if you want to dig back in the archives. But Nathan, thanks for jumping on with me again.
Yeah, honored to be here. Excited to get to talk and to know a little bit.
I love our conversations. What were your thoughts of the convention this year?
It was a blast. You know, being the first one that I came to get to go to, really the biggest thing, you know, being on the stage and looking down and being in the crowd and looking at the stage, I got to see both aspects of it. The amazing thing about it was just the great camaraderie between all the coaches and everybody that was there doing certain aspects of, you know, lending advice to each other, but also, you know, kind of brainstorming together about, you know, ways that we can kind of change the way that the game is played in terms of the strength conditioning realm and my avenue, or just other pieces of it. So it was a great experience. I highly recommend it to anybody. And it was an absolute blast.
And you reached out to me after the convention because you were involved in a lot of different things. You said, hey, I've got some thoughts from the convention on maybe to help streamline some communication between everyone.
Yeah, I know. I think the main thing I see that works the best in my realm is the communication aspect of getting involved with other people and creating either small groups or whatnot to where we can kind of build off each other and stay in front of each other more often, because things get going so fast in the daily life of practice, games, traveling, whatever, to where it's 6 months down the road and it's like, holy cow, I haven't talked to someone in so long. And really, there are certain times of year it gets tougher, but we also lose track of a lot of things that way because the days go by so fast.
I mean, and I've asked you this question in the past, but what do coaches, parents, and players need to hear now?
I think the main thing they need to hear now is consistency throughout the course of a year. One of the issues that we run into a lot at our program is it becomes springtime, high school baseball season, or summertime, and all of a sudden the idea that I'm too busy to continue to take care of my body becomes a big problem. And I know it's because there's a lot of travel involved. There's a lot of games involved. Here in Kansas, they just added more games this year. But that's the most important time of year. We don't want to fall apart. It's a nonstop grind from when games start end of February, beginning of March, until they're pretty much done end of July. And if we wait for that entire period, not only are we going to get worse, but at the same time, like, the chances of us getting hurt during that time go through the roof. And so the main thing is trying to get rid of that aspect of, like, well, I don't have time. And the first question I ask the parent or the athlete is, does your son want to play college baseball? And they're like, well, yeah, absolutely. Well, guess what? In college baseball, they will do this year round all the time, sometimes more than twice a week, even in season. And I think that's where we can kind of relay with our pro guys and our college guys, say, yep, this is what we're doing, but we're bringing it to you at a younger age to make sure you're prepared for that, because that is a giant shell shock when you get to the college level.
Is the difference with the younger kids maybe the volume that you're going at it with them?
Yeah, I think that I would agree with that, because it's a less controlled environment in the college setting. In college, like, everything's controlled, right? We know when practices, we know how much they're doing here. We have certain hours that were allotted here and there. At a younger age, it could be a five-hour practice randomly, or it could be they're practicing baseball, then soccer the next day, and then they have this going on. And so we really have to, like, manage their stimuluses and the stress on them a lot more at that younger age, because without that, they're just revving high all the time.
And you said you're doing some new assessments with guys?
Yeah, so we, about 3 years ago, we started doing arm assessments on our college and pro arms, trying to predict arm injuries, because I think that's right now the big thing, right? If we could predict an arm injury coming, like, it would be amazing. So for me and our staff, we wanted to dive in to figure out, is there a way to predict what's happening in these arms? So that, for two reasons, if we have a college kid, we can say, hey, college coach, this kid has a healthy arm, he's ready to go. Or on the other side of, hey, you really need to slow down, we're starting to get to where we're not, it's going to become a problem, we have to fix some things. And so we took that and paired that with our performance testing to say, we want health as well as we also want performance. Rather than one or the other, we want to attack both of these to make sure that the athletes that we come out of our program and we work with are not only becoming more explosive and faster and whatnot, better for baseball, but also healthy. Because no matter what, if you're not healthy, you're not helping the team.
Chuck Wolf was on with me about a month ago, and he's done a lot of research on front hip immobility affecting arm. Are you seeing the same thing with that, with arm injuries with the front hip?
Yep. So the hip internal external rotation, big piece of it. The block leg, if the block leg can't clear, then you're thrown across your body, more stress on the elbow shoulder, case in point, basic. It really all starts with the foot too. If their foot plant's not good and they have instability in the ankle, it's just going to work its way up the chain. So we look at hip internal external rotation ability. We look at the T-spine separation, because one of the buzzwords is hip to shoulder separation. But it's nice because you can tell an athlete like, hey, you don't have T-spine. And the reason why you don't is because your hips are too tight. And if you clear the hips, then the T-spine will clear up itself. And then we look at shoulder flexion, internal external rotation, and then we speak to those about how the two that we see based off research are the most important: our shoulder flexion, raising arm all the way over our head, and then internal rotation, our ability to come through here without having my shoulder jump up into my ear. And the reason why is it comes into deceleration. Everybody is so obsessed right now with acceleration, velocity, velocity, velocity. It's like driving a Ferrari with no brake pads. Your Ferrari won't go very fast no matter what, because there's no brakes. And so we really try to hone that into athletes, because they all do want to throw harder, but if their brake system is not a high level brake system, it's not really going to matter. The body's going to either shut itself down so it doesn't hurt, or it's going to go too much and hurt itself.
What are the correctives? So say we've got some hip immobility or T-spine immobility. What are the correctives we can do for that?
So the big thing is identifying if it's a tightness issue or a knot issue, because you can do yoga 24/7, but if it's not a tightness issue, it's not going to fix it. The same on the opposite spectrum with soft tissue work. 9 times out of 10, what we find with athletes, especially at the younger ages, they're just so knotted up because they sit, they play 1,000 sports, they don't take time off, they don't ever take care of themselves. And so a lot of times they're just knotted up, and you release that tension, all of a sudden we have 10 degrees more of motion in 15 minutes. Yes, it's going to go back to where it was, but it's a perpetual thing we have to keep working on. But it's amazing what you can make progress-wise. The problem is that everybody knows that soft tissue work and stretching is not sexy. So it's nothing that you're going to see on YouTube or, you know, a big leaguer is like, this is the most important thing to me, but it's what helps keep us going, right? So we can do those high level things we want to do all the time and get rid of those little knick-knack injuries, because we hear it all the time with pitchers. It's the bicep or the front of the shoulder pain, or with the hitter, it's their low back. And unless it's an actual like fall injury or whatnot, usually it's built up over time. And we have to release that tension to help create that better muscle pattern.
And I still use those 4 spots that you showed at the Barnstormers. I still use it. Use the yoga tune-up balls. I still hit those 4 spots. And I'm not throwing anywhere near. I used to throw in the fast. But when I throw now, it's way better than it was for me in the past. I mean, you talked about it's like pulling a rope that's got a knot. If you keep stretching that knot's going anywhere. Knot's not going anywhere, so you have to try to get that knot to release.
Yeah, and the big thing too, like I tell athletes, is like when you do that 4 spots and then you try to throw off that, man, why aren't those loose and whippy? And it's like, perfect, that's what you want. We don't want a slow, stiff arm. We want a loose, whippy arm where the lower half creates all the torque and leverage and things going on so the arm can follow through. And so what we kind of have added to that repertoire is something for our hips, to where we can help release the hips, because if the hips don't rotate, the arm's got to throw harder to get to where we need to have. And then our arm is either lagging behind, or we're having to use the shoulder the entire time rather than utilizing our lower half.
Are you seeing that in the psoas? Are you seeing that in other areas that need to be released in the hip?
So usually if it were in rotational wise, what we see is it's your glute med, which is, we call it your side butt cheek. It's really right behind your hip bone on the side. And we'll do manual therapy on kids or have them lay on a lacrosse ball in that position. But it really is what locks kids down in that internal rotational issue, which back hip, front hip is either going to block you from extending all the way and using your back leg, or it's going to not allow you to clear the front side. Either way, hitting or throwing, it becomes a problem in terms of efficiency.
Are you having them just lay on the lacrosse ball when they do it? Are you having them move their leg in any way, or is it they just sitting on it to breathe into it to get it released?
That's great. So there's 2 ways to go about it. I like to put them in a position where they're going to be in terms of sport. So we have them actually bend their leg up to 90 degrees, because it's the same thing when we do like the trap work. If I'm pushing on my trap here and it feels fine, great, when I throw my arms up here. So we have to put them in that position. As well as when you find that knot, our goal is to help break that tension. So sometimes some movement will help with that. And it really comes down to the athlete, but usually
we call it striping. So yep. When you get to that spot and roll back and forth on it, it's called striping.
Yep. And our goal is to get them to get used to it, right? So against the wall is less pressure. Start with that, and then you work onto the floor. But in all honesty, the more pressure you can give, the better. The biggest thing that people run into is they want to do it for a long period of time, no longer than 30 to 60 seconds, because you can bruise a muscle. We don't want that to happen.
But we find that a contusion. I had a player at Western Illinois, good arm, and he came back from Christmas break. He had gone to see a doctor. He'd always dealt with some elbow issues, but he came back and his elbow was bruised. I'm like, what are you doing? He goes, well, I've been taking a baseball and doing it for like 10 minutes every day. I'm like, you just caused a terrible contusion in your arm, because with that stuff,
with certain athletes, you have to give them those specific, excuse me, because otherwise they're like, well, more is better, right? Like, well, not necessarily. Yeah. But it's also one of those things where if you do it on a consistent basis, the amount of time you have to spend on it is way less. Okay. And so when we added that flexibility part to our screenings, we decided that this is a great way for us to say, hey, red flag here, yellow flag here, and create specifics of what we're looking for. Because right now we also have about seven teams that we deal with, either in-house or remotely. So we'll travel, we'll evaluate the entire team, build them a program based off of what the evaluations say. And it kind of gives us some specifics, but also gives us norms of like, hey, here's a good normative place we need to be, because no one's going to be perfect, but we need to stay in that realm so that if we stay that way through the entire season, then we're good to go in realms of power production and of flexibility work.
You're saying 30 seconds to a minute, but how often? So in a 7-day week, how often should we hit those spots?
You know, and it depends on the athlete, but I personally, our guys do it every day. Mostly because they're practicing every day or playing every day. The high schools that we deal with in person, we go to them before their practice. And so we're doing more of prep work. So we're getting them pretty much ready to go, mobilized, recovered, and then out to practice. And then we have a couple teams we do after practice lifts and things like that. But really the main thing comes down to is getting them flushed and getting them recovered to get out there to do it again. And again, we actually added force plate testing into our protocols this spring as well. And the great thing about it was we could test power production of our athletes pre-season and post-season and know that we're within a 5% range of power. So over the course of an entire high school season, we at most lost only 5%. We know we're still at a high level for the summer baseball, which is great for our kids here, because that's when club season is. That's when travel season is. But it's a good metric for kids to see right in front of them.
Any sort of warm up to get the blood going before they jump into hitting those spots?
So that actually is the warm up in itself, okay. Mostly because what it's going to do is increase blood flow. And then we go to our movement pattern things after that, getting them to learn, you know, once they release tension to go into. That's their warm-up. It gets their blood pumping. You get that movement going. And then we go into our movement patterning of releasing the hip flexor, releasing rotation of the hips and those aspects, just because we can't release the hip rotation without the hip flexor, because the hip flexor will lock down. So I always tell kids, go after the hip flexor first before you go after the rotation, because if you don't release the hip flexor, when you go to rotate, you're just literally pinching down on that spot. I mean, that's what you're feeling in the front of your hip at that time.
What are you seeing with the sweet spot with pre and post throw protocol stuff too, as far as warm up and then recovery?
So usually for a warm up, it's more of movement based. We're getting that the whole muscle kind of activated, loosened up. A lot of the guys are like, hey, I'm a Theragun guy or whatever. Great time for that. Post wise, to help break that tension, we're looking at smashing. So we're putting pressure and holding at that point. We do some static stretching and whatnot, but of what I have found, most kids feel better with that soft tissue release, just because a lot of the issues come up from them just getting so knotted up.
Is there there is such a thing as then too much with all this too, correct?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it is one of those things. And as well as, like, if you do it once a month and you do it for 6 hours, it's still not going to make it any better. It's all about consistency. And then finding it part of your routine. Routines. We've got a couple guys that are lat dominant guys, so we spend more time on their lats and their rotator cuff and their armpit more than their pec. We got a couple of guys that are really chest dominant pec guys that play football. We need to work on that part of it too. So I think part of it is, as an athlete, is figuring out, you know, what those 3 to 4 things you need to work on and then hammering home at those rather than doing the whole gambit. Because, you know, if your hamstrings are never tight, you could probably move on from those, but you should focus on how bad your quads are or your hips are or that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I just pass right through. When I'm hitting my areas, if I hit an area and it doesn't have anything, it's like, okay, that area is fine. I don't need to worry about it.
Right, right. As well as a lot of these guys, they travel. I mean, they sit in a car and a bus for 6 to 8 hours. You know, you're going to feel terrible when you get out. Like, what can you do after that point to make sure you recover for the next day? And that was the one thing that we would ask guys, like, okay, bus ride from Kansas City to Tennessee. What do you need at the hotel? Go lay in bed. Okay, well, how do you feel the next day? I feel terrible. Yeah, well, you literally did nothing, right? So let's create a protocol of get in the pool and do some jogging, get into, you know, the thing like that. So the best thing about all those pieces are, is that we have an app that we use that allows us to program for those athletes. So there's no way of getting away from it. And it's right in front of them.
Have you seen the injuries decrease then?
Overall, yeah, knock on wood, we've been very fortunate in keeping eyes on those things. It's also talking to kids and educating them on like when you're in pain, when you're not in pain, what does that mean? But what we have noticed is longevity of performance throughout the season while also maintaining the flexibility aspect. So instead of just like focusing on the lifting stuff all the time, focusing on both of them and noticing that our performance is staying at a high level and our guys are maintaining their velocity for longer and throughout the summer.
When are you pre-test and post-test and velocity with your guys?
So throwing wise, we don't touch them at all unless it's our college or pro arms. We kind of go off what their clubs do. Mostly because here in Kansas City, most clubs have their own winter throwing programs. So our goal alongside that is to use our flexibility and performance-based force plates, sprinting stuff, all that kind of stuff, and tag that with what they're doing with their pitching coaches. Ideally, once a quarter would be great because you can see them right for the high school season, right for the summer, right after the summer, and then right after that one actual off season you have with them. But you know, it kind of depends on the athlete and their how often they come in. But if you can do it once a quarter, it'd be great. As a coach, it's great to give you a perspective year round. As an athlete, it's great too because it kind of creates that accountability of like, well, you've lost 15% of power in season and you're down 15 degrees across the board. What have you been doing? Nothing. Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. Or the other side of it, hey, you've increased your power 10% in season. Our flexibility is maintaining. How do you feel? And there's those guys that coast through the state tournament and go straight into club ball and they're good to go.
With your pro and college guys, with your arms, what are some characteristics of the off-season throwing programs that they enjoy? And what are maybe some ones that they feel like need to be tweaked? Since you're with the athletes, I don't want you to name names, but I think
part of it is some schools do a really good job of like, if a kid has a routine and it works, stick to the routine rather than saying, this is our program. You do it like we do here. Now, if they don't have a routine, then that's great. You know, give them a routine. Some schools do a great job of individualizing, you know, this guy is a reliever. This guy is a starter. This guy is a this. This is how their throwing program should mimic. In some schools, the kids sometimes like the factor of like ours is more of like we're more 85% plus base intensity wise when it comes to throwing or comes to running, lifting, because we want to mimic what they're doing on the field. And I think a lot has changed. When I first started doing this, you know, in the private setting 11 years ago, I would say that the college baseball scene has changed a lot in terms of like philosophies into what they're morphing into. So I think we're going in a great direction. I think we also, you know, have to continue on our end to understand that when we're pushing the edge of human performance, because that's what everybody wants to do, right? Hit harder, throw harder, run harder. We have to backbone support it with the best system we can to help it protect it from falling apart. And we need checks and balances along the way to ensure that we are doing that rather than saying, okay, you're good to go. We'll see you in 8 months. And all of a sudden it's like, where are we at the end of it?
We talk so much about the arms, but how can people ensure preseason that their legs are ready to take the workload of sprinting that much?
I think you got to sprint. I mean, there's a great couple of great articles that were put out about when you don't sprint, you lose speed in like 3 to 5 days. And it's one of those things where it's a constant thing you have to do. I'm not saying you'd run 60s left and right, but you know, the ability to sprint very short, but time 10, 15 yards is extremely important in baseball. I think on top of that, deceleration is so important because baseball is a game of acceleration and deceleration. And if we can't decelerate correctly, a lot of hamstring problems come up in that issue as well. And so balancing those out, as well as, you know, as you're morphing toward the preseason, the lifting for us turns into more of explosive movements at a less percentage rather than we're maxing out before tryouts because, yes, we want to have a great base of strength, but we want to also make sure that that strength is dynamic and can move and things like that.
Is that also a hip or an ankle immobility thing maybe causing hamstring issues also?
Could be. Technique-wise, yeah. A lot of guys that will pop out of their stance in terms of running have bad ankle mobility because your body will follow your shin angle. So if the shin can't get to where it needs to get to, which is a whole nother talk about base stealing and how people do that kind of stuff. But that's extremely important, as well as a factor with pitching. If you have bad ankle mobility, your block leg is not going to be where it needs to get to. And now we're going to have leaking, or we're going to have things like that. We're just losing power out of that part.
What about working diagonally and then working laterally too, with some of the exercises
Oh,
to help with that?
yeah, I think absolutely. Everybody always talks about, the vertical jump is so important in certain sports. I'm less about that because we don't really play in that plane as much. It's a rotational plane that's that and to the lateral side. So we like to add lunge complexes, step ups in the lateral planes, cable movements, the band movement, things like that. The spectrums of baseball are like, train extremely hard, get really, really strong and slow, or train, just body weight. We do a lot of reps. Like, we have to find the mid ground, and everybody's different, which is why we love and hate baseball training, is because not one program works for every baseball athlete, because they're so different in what they do in terms of body types and what positions. But I think that, yeah, working in all planes of motion and then working single arm and single leg is so important, because literally in life, we're shifting back and forth. In baseball and throwing, we're literally trying to transfer force from one leg to the next leg to do certain things. So full body movements are a definite must.
How much time are you spending then rotating the other direction? Obviously, with your right-handed throwers, they're going to rotate that side. How much time are you trying to spend to counteract that rotating to the other side?
That's something we've looked at in terms of like how we could battle it. And
Or
really,
does it even really matter?
in the in-season, it does, because they do it so much that we don't rotate in season at all. We all anti-rotate, anti-extend, because it's just one of those things where it becomes, what are we doing, right? And same time, like, we're trying to fix a catcher's squat pattern. We're never going to fix it because they're going to squat a million times the way they catch. So we need to mimic the movement to fix, or to fix and fit what we're trying to do. Off-season wise, we always do the exact same on both sides in terms of med ball throws and whatnot with our guys. We use it as partly as comedic relief for our pitchers that are not good on their on dominant side, but also just give the body some synergy. You'd actually be amazed how many guys, you
There's
don't
some
cue
brain
them.
patterning stuff with that too,
Yeah.
going in the
And
opposite
you don't, yeah,
direction.
you don't cue them. You just hey, be athletic, and let's just see your body move. And they actually do better sometimes on their non-dominant side, because they're just not so programmed. They're just free and loose. And we like to see that kind of part of it too.
How young are the kids coming in to you?
So our youngest kid is going into fifth grade. Anything below that, the structure gets really tough for them. We want to have them like go out and have fun. My son's 7. He loves coming in and doing stuff, but it's more like, let's just have fun and mess around and be a kid. But the structure for us starts in fifth grade. So our youth program is 5th to 8th. Then we have a high school program, and then our college and pro guys are separate. And then remote wise is all high school based, just because of the sheer amount we're asking them to do on an app.
With the youth kids, what is keeping those kids healthy that you're coming into from a workload standpoint and a 12-month calendar standpoint?
I think learning basic movement patterns is so important at that age. Learn to squat, learn to hinge, learn to do a push-up, learn to do a plank, crawl, throw, rotate. I think the problem that we see is these kids, they just play, and now at a younger age, they're playing more and more and more and more games, which is just more stress, and we're not helping relieve that. And then they come in and they're 15, 16, 17, they have bad movement patterns. So you're having to correct that, which is hindering them at the start. And then building that back up, which just takes more time. So a lot of times our kids that come through the youth program into the high school program far succeed, at least in the weight room, what our kids are doing, because their movements have just been progressed at the right rate, rather than rushing to put as much weight on the bar, or, watch me do this or whatever.
Have you had much success with the pro guys of getting them to change movement patterns?
The question is, the answer is yes and no. Their off seasons are so short. A lot of times it's just trying to get them put back together, and then educate them a little bit, so when they get to the pro level, they know how to take care of themselves. Granted, they have, great facility staffs for those guys, but a lot of times there's so many of them and only one coach that a lot of it's on your own. And a lot of guys are different. So if a certain guy likes a certain thing, do it more often. Just because the team's not doing it doesn't mean you don't have to. And then a lot of times the communication between us and the pro staffs is what I feel like helps the most, because they don't get to see them in the off season, which is the one time you can actually push the pedal down. So getting with them and getting their exit meeting of, hey, we need this guy here, 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 allows for us to help build to that, rather than them saying, we'll see you in 4 months, hopefully you're ready to go. Because when they get back, it's the dials turn up, and they have to be ready. And at certain points, the older they get, the more experienced they are, they know where they need to be, pro guy wise, when they show up at camp. But a lot of times these young guys are, they're wanting to show so much when they get there. They're almost too ready sometimes.
With your seven-year-old, how many sports is he playing?
Plays three. Baseball, basketball, football. Whatever sport he's playing is his favorite at the time. You know, it's one of those things where he's getting to the point where the academy things and the club stuff starts. But really, I want him to have fun. You know, I really want him to progress as he wants to. You know, I try to make him a left-hander for the longest time. I'm left-handed, but it didn't work. So he is right-handed, but we're looking at a switch hitter maybe. I don't know. His swing isn't too bad. But yeah, I mean, the greatest thing about being a parent is getting to be watched, like the small things happen. Just, you know, I get to help coach all the teams, whether it be an assistant or in charge of one of them. And it's like, man, I forgot how hard it was to teach a kid how to throw a baseball. Like, I'm just like, you know, the more higher level, like very advanced things. And it's like, no, I just need him to learn how to like catch and then throw the ball back to somebody.
And you're keeping those seasons separate?
Yes. Yeah. So
ending of the seasons.
Well, a little of them do, like fall football and fall baseball do, but we stick to one practice a week. You know, we have a couple kids that he's played with that are playing three or four sports at once, and they miss every practice and they just play games. And for me, it's like, that's the only way they're ever going to learn. And I think that part of it, and it's tough for kids at that age, but like, is the education of like how you actually play the sport correctly, because then they get to the higher levels and they can do all the cool stuff and this and that, but they can't do the basics. They don't know what bunt coverage is. They don't know what this is, which I get it. Like that's old man talk right there, right? Bunt coverages and that kind of stuff. But you'd be amazed how many games get won because someone makes an error or a mistake on a very simple free out. And so, yeah, we try to keep it to at least, you know, one practice a week per sport. So he's got two practices and then maybe two games at most. But then he's in the backyard doing the same stuff over and over again. So, you know, that's the fun part as a dad, go out there and throw a batting practice. And then he's like, let me see you hit. And I'm like, no, it's been a while. I don't want to do that. And then, you know, you end up like, you know, tearing your back up or doing something silly because we haven't done it in forever.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of youth camp right now. And so going back, and I just love being around the young kids because I use some of the college drills. Like we had hitting camp all week. And so we use connection balls underneath their elbow. We use connection balls in between their hips. We use med ball tosses. A lot of the stuff that we're doing for the college guys, you can still help kids use all those things. I'm a big proponent of med ball tosses, jump backs, and scoop throws for young kids. It was a 2-pound med ball. But we had 6-year-olds doing 2-pound med ball tosses.
Sure. Well, I think part of it, too, is that kids just learn differently than they used to. You know, it's almost every kid now is a visual learner. And they need some kind of feedback to remind them they're doing something correctly or put them in the correct position. It's just how it is. And so I think that, you know, trying to morph the old school great drills into what would work for kids today is like the best way to go about it. Because otherwise, you know, you tell them this and they're like, I have no idea what that means. Can you show me? And it's like, no, you just need to do it. Well, that doesn't work in a lot of kids' days age. And so, you know, having those aspects, like you said, the connection balls or make the med balls, because it makes it fun. Like, I want you to throw this ball. I want you to rotate and throw this thing. Because on the other side of things, what I see a lot is that kids are terrified of messing up. And so they get very timid. And all of a sudden now the swing is not loose and free. It's like this like real slow stop at connection or stop at contact kind of swing. It's like, no, I want you to really go through this. And so I think that's also what med balls do a great job of, is getting kids to like be loose and free, because they all try to swing with their arms and it's lower half, and let the arms follow through.
Yeah. I'll get a lot of, did I do that right? And I'll be like, how'd it feel?
Yeah.
Did I do it right? How'd it feel?
Yeah. Yep. Well, I had a kid that was like, you know, I was helping out at camp and I was like, all right, we're going to go so-and-so. I want you to stand on the right side of me. And the kid was like, didn't know where to go. I'm like, what arm do you throw with? He goes, I don't know. I'm like, okay, this is a little bit tougher situation than I thought. But I think that, yeah, you know, starting with that age and making it fun and making them, you know, learn those basics is only going to take off in terms as they grow and develop and whatnot. Because we're just finishing up machine pitch. We've got one more season of machine pitch. And it's like, now it comes kid pitch. And like, it gets real at this point. You can't be, you know, digging in the sand, kids hitting a ground ball or a line drive at your face, as well as, you know, kids start kind of finding their positions and where they like to be and all that kind of stuff. But it is kind of fun to move them around and figure out, like, you know, where they really like to be. You know, all of a sudden you got a kid that loves catching, like, which, I mean, catching is the most abused position in baseball. So it takes a certain person to be a catcher. But I just find it being an absolute blast at that age.
So your pre-practice warm up with the young kids, what are you doing with them pre-practice before you get going?
Honestly, run them a little bit, get their the energy out of them so they can be focused. The one thing I found, and it took me a while to figure it out, was like with younger kids, like if you want them to focus, they have to have a little bit of fatigue in them. Otherwise, they just like they're all over the place. And then create structure, because if you don't, they go by the wayside real quick. You know, there's a couple teams that we've played that they're an hour early, and I'm like, that's a little bit much for a kid to stay, you know, in tune what's going on. But also like hammer home, you know, the basics of like getting to play catch with each other. You know, a lot of times we would first start it with like, okay, dad's playing catch with kid. Well, it's dad can throw it wherever he needs to. Kid's going to always throw it right to dad. Dad can catch wherever. Get them to learn how to throw it to each other. Get them to learn how to field a ground ball out in front of themselves. And then, you know, get them to be not afraid of the ball. That's the one thing that I took for granted, I guess, because when I was growing up, our second baseman's grandfather was our coach, and he would hit ground balls so hard at you, he actually cracked his own grandson's cup. And like, I was never afraid of the ball though after that point. So, I mean, as weird as it sounds, like that's like one of those things where you get in front of the ball, knock it down, do what you got to do, and the glove will work when it works.
Tennis balls and wiffle balls and rag balls are your best friend with that age group of kids.
Actually, Coach Tyler Kincaid from Kansas City, he told me a drill about using sandbags when get kids learn how to catch. So you throw them the sandbag and they try to catch it like this and they squeeze it, because the gloves, and that's the thing I found, is kids' gloves are like they don't move because they're so tiny. So buying the kid an actual larger glove that's more floppy is easier for them to catch. But I never thought about that sandbag to learn how to, like, you know, work your hand and the eye coordination part of it.
So heading into the fall then here with reassessing guys, you reassess all your high school, college, pro guys. Well, your pro guys are still in it, but your high school and college guys, you reassess all of them?
Reassess them, put them on the force plates, take them through the performance stuff, the sprinting work, the flexibility work as well. Kind of gives them an outline of like, hey, going back to school, here's where you're at. You know, if a conversation comes up from a strength coach or a PT or a head coach, pitching coach, here's the data. I think the one thing that the private setting has to continue to remember is that we're all on the same page. The goal is the athlete development. So we have to do everything we can to stay up with those teams and make sure that those guys know that those kids are coming in the way they need them to come in. And I think that that's a huge part of why we get returning athletes from certain schools and certain programs, but also our remote stuff and team stuff has continued to grow in terms of like the teams you have in Kansas City and remotely is because of the communication, but also like showing an aspect of like not only performance increasing, but like, let's show flexibility increasing. Let's have, you know, the number one question I ask these remote coaches is, how was the injury rate this year in the high school? Oh, we were great. We had no arm injury. We had one kid that had a little bit of soreness, went away really quickly. To me, that's a win, because if we stack that team for the state title, the healthiest team's probably going to win usually.
Do better sprinters have tighter hamstrings?
What I've seen, yes. And that's the one, that's funny, the other key.
You talk about assessment every year. I went in for training and they'd be like, you got to stretch your hamstrings. But I was like, I think it might be a good thing because I can run really fast.
Well, and the thing that we found too is like, you know, you've got a spectrum, right? The guys that are really, really tight, really explosive, right? Awesome. High risk of injury. Guys that are really lax, you know, very flexible, high risk of injury. So you've got to kind of move them in a certain range. You know, I'll never forget the story about John Means when he first started training us when he was in AA with the Orioles. And we were doing some strength movement with him one day, and we were doing like just power pulls. So like, you know, deadlift off the ground, tiptoe shrug, drop the bar, whatever. And he's just ripping like 365 pounds off the ground like it was a twig. And I'm like, and strength done. Good. Here we go. Flexibility is the next thing. And it's like, it's cool to watch, but it's one of those things where it's like, you just have to be able to analyze that. And as a coach, we got to swallow the factor of like, he doesn't need to be any stronger, but he needs to move better. And a lot of guys, we find is that they continue to go down the rabbit hole of what they're really good at, which only gets them away from what they need to be working on because it's uncomfortable or things like that. And so we worked on John's block leg hamstring flexibility, well, both of them, but mainly his block leg hamstring flexibility to extend that front knee because he was so tight and so strong. And there was days for like 2 weeks he'd walk in like limping because his hamstrings were so tired and fatigued from us cranking on him. And then it finally worked. So it's one of those things where you just have to continue to like find what's going to help them at the end of the day be better at their sport and have health, really. And we know that there's nothing depicts any kind of throwing velocity, anything, whatever, in terms of like scientific proof, in terms of the weight room. So we have to keep pushing the bounds to figure that out. Cause if we can figure that out, we're on something pretty good.
Are you going to open another facility at any point?
So we are currently at 4 in Kansas City. I think that's probably pretty good, mostly because what I see the value in what we do is a lot of these schools that are in smaller areas, they don't have access to good strength and conditioning. A lot of the remote stuff we do are in cities that just don't have access to quality training, and they need that. And the kids really want it, and they'll bust their tails for that. So I've really enjoyed that part of getting out and meeting coaches, speaking, and doing the remote stuff, because it challenges me as a coach to, I'm behind a screen, how can I make them do exactly what I need them to do? But also, we're bringing a quality service to someone who really, really needs it and wants it.
Did you think this is what it was going to look like when you got done with the Cardinals?
100% no.
Because that was your that was your fail forward moment, was leaving the Cardinals to start to get on this side of it.
It was. And I, every once in a while, I get that little itch of like, hey, there's a major league job open. There's a major league job open. But you know, I really do enjoy where I'm at, and I love what we get to do, to, like I said, go out and work with these athletes, because most colleges, most pro teams have their structure set what they needed. It's these high school kids that are kind of lacking and wanting to be at that position. And I've really enjoyed that part of it. And I never thought I would speak. Like when I spoke, you know, at APCA, it was one of those things where it was like, I've spoken in front of like, you know, 50, 100 people and whatnot, but I did not expect that. And I had an absolute blast from the feedback of just like, man, we really appreciate it. This really could help us. Because the main reason why I got into this realm was to be able to give back to those that helped me along the way, but also try to be the person that I needed when I was at that age to get me to where I wanted to be.
When you were putting your presentation together, how hard was that? Because you probably had so much information. You only get 38 minutes. How hard was that to concise what you wanted to get out?
It was. I was also, when I was told, like, you need to make sure there's things in there that people can use. And that was the main gist of what I wanted, was I wanted people walking out of here like sheets of notes of like, hey, we could do this tomorrow. That was the preface. You know, I try to think about it as like a series. Like if I was going to go and write a book, like this would be chapter one, and then chapter two would be this. Because what I didn't want to overdo is overwhelm people with like 1,000 slides in the period of time. I wanted them to actually be able to pay attention to what was going on. So that was the overall goal. And of course, as a, you know, a perfectionist, you go back and nitpick and change this and do that. I spent numerous nights in the basement giving the presentation to a wall. My wife can tell you, when I was actually there, I probably gave it like 4 or 5 times in one day, and she'd sit and make funny faces at me and try to throw me off and such. So, but no, it was definitely series one, and I'm excited for what's next in the future and all that stuff.
With your college and pro guys, any new supplements out there or supplementation that they're using that they like? Could be for anything.
Not necessarily. Because I feel like that there's the basics, right? You take creatine the right way, you take protein the right way. What I will say that I've noticed a lot is a lot of guys just take protein, right? They're just doing protein powder or whatnot. The problem is they're missing all the carbohydrate part of it that makes it so important. So that would be the one main thing I would harp on people, is that ability for them to make sure they're recovering correctly, so they're going to replenish all that burned off energy they've been using in their muscles. And you can go out and buy powders. You can go buy that. Honestly, I recommend gummy bears, because I love gummy candy. And so it makes me feel good about, I can eat it then. But the one you want to go with is the Hard World Gold Pack. It has dextrose, which is actually what you're getting from those products you're buying powder-wise. But that one, creatine, you know, is a great one. I think the thing for a lot of guys to be careful of is just kind of getting them to understand what pre-workout is, if they're going to take it. And read the darn label, because we have kids that will walk in, and I'm like, you literally are taking way too much of this. This is ridiculous. And it's a slippery slope, because it is a stimulant. You have to keep adding more and more and more and more. So that's probably the main thing we try to educate our kids on, in terms of that stuff.
What do you take? You take anything?
I do. I take creatine. I take protein
every day.
I do creatine. I do the Harbro barrels, I'm a big greens guy in the morning. For some reason, in the college setting, I got into emergency and greens in the mornings to help, you know, with being around kids all the time, not getting sick. Knock on wood, it's gone pretty well for me. I do take ZMA at night, which is zinc, magnesium, aspirate, literally two minerals.
Oh, big ZMA fan.
And there's some, once again, there's other products you can buy that are powders that are really expensive.
Magnesium glycinate is the one that I take mostly now, but when I was training a bunch, ZMA was a big fan of mine. Yeah. I was a big fan.
It's great, great sleep. I'll tell you that.
It's phenomenal sleep. What else do we need to cover? What else do we need to?
We nailed it. I think the one thing I will say that with the performance stuff is looking at force plate technology. I have a feeling that's going to be a huge thing moving forward. And we like to categorize our guys based off their load patterns, just because in baseball, there's a great Sparta Science out in California does a really good job breaking this down. I think that they go really in depth. We try to bring it down because we're working with high school kids and college kids and whatnot. But looking at movement patterns of what baseball players are doing in terms of like the load phase and the explosive phase, I think a lot of times we try to train people in the quick twitch, pop, pop, as fast as possible phase, which works in football, works in basketball. But most baseball loaders are the slower one, where it's a slow load and then a prolonged burst. And we've actually tested with some athletes where we've done a broad jump down and up as fast as possible, or with like a 2 to 3 second eccentric load, and they'll jump 3 to 6 inches further on that eccentric load because of that's how their sport pattern loads. Now, middle infielders, center fielders can probably be a little bit different, but at the same time,
and the throwing is that there's that slow build up to an explosive movement.
Yep. And so we've kind of hammered away at that on some of our guys, and we can like look at their differences on the force plates of you have inefficient power per your own body weight, or your load patterns are off, and then add that into a training program, which as a coach makes it fun to kind of adapt training to, and work on those things. Cause you may have some guys that are really quicks and they're losing a lot of force, or you have guys that are just like slow as an ox and they need a little quick. But once again, that's the chess match of baseball training.
Cause I mean, you've seen that, you've been around it forever. You've seen this thing evolve. I mean, what are some of the other evolutions or where you feel like this is going to go?
We use a lot of tendo units too. And one of the things I find is trying to get athletes to give intensity, right? To want to move things fast, to want to do this. And so we started using tendo units for that reason, to get kids like, you know, to challenge them rather than saying you versus me, who lifts more weight. Well, if you're stronger than me, I don't want to hurt myself doing that. That's not smart. So if we can put that into a realm of getting you, okay, you need to move it this fast if you want to add weight, a lot of people will want to do that. The second thing is auto-regulation of, you know, they may come in one day and they don't feel good. You know, you may have a guy who caught not 12 innings the day before because it was a long game, and you've got trap bar deadlift today. Well, if you put them on a tendo, no matter what weight they're using, if they're in that speed you're looking to get, it doesn't matter. You're getting the training stimulus that you want. I think that allows for us to auto-regulate kids, especially when you're not just one-on-one, you're working with a group, but also drives competition because the one thing I feel like that kids have changed a little bit in today's age versus 10 years ago is like they just don't compete as much as they used to. And I think it's partly because of the way social media is. They compete via social media or by my videos or my tweets or my stats rather than me versus you right here, right now kind of thing. And so I try to bring that a little bit
competitive. You watch them play a video game. You watch them play any of those games that my son plays, my 21-year-old play. They're still competitive. They're just competitive in different ways.
Sure. Sure. So it's trying to draw that out of them, right? And so putting like that nomer on, you know, a tendo.
There's a gamification really piece to that too, a little bit with the tendo in it.
Yep, absolutely. And it's not the see all be all, right? It's always a tool. But as long as you have a reason for using it and getting the results that you want, that's what you're looking for.
Thank you, sir, for your time. It's always a pleasure. I always enjoy talking to you.
Yeah, thank you. Good talking to you as well. We'll talk soon.
I have a lot of respect for Coach Hemphill. I think he has as good a feel for training baseball players as anyone in our industry. I also really enjoy our conversations. Thanks again to John Litchfield, Zach Hale, Jim Richardson, Matt West, and Antonio Walker in the ABC office for all their help on the podcast. Feel free to reach out to me via email, rbrownlee@abca.org, Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram @coachb_abca, or direct message me via the MyABCA app. This is Ryan Brownlee signing off for the American Baseball Coaches Association. Thanks, and leave it better for those behind you. Turn.